What a wonderful job you guys are doing, putting on a conference and hosting me, and just the general vibe of this room. I move around a lot in AA, all around different parts of the country, and all I can tell you is this ain't happening everywhere. I mean, when we talk about pockets of enthusiasm, there's something going on here. And, you know, and a lot of the stuff I'm covering, I know I'm preaching to the choir, you know, on a great deal of it. I hope some of it has some, maybe a different angle, different line, different thing here and there. But this is a pretty special group of guys. You know, I go to a men's conference in Texas, and I'd like to just import this whole group and invade our little deal, you know, because it's a little different energy. That would be awesome, man. We could, because they. But yeah, road trip, yeah. Yeah. Shotgun, yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I was telling some of the guys this morning, of course, Charlie Parker, alcoholic. I was telling some of the guys this morning, I mean, the first time I ever got asked to go do a workshop was up in New Jersey. And this friend of mine, Chris Schroeder, asked me to come up there. And I was looking at Katie and I go, what the hell are we going to talk about? You know, Friday. I'm still a little nervous about getting up and doing a 1 hour talk, you know. And I was like, what are we going to talk about Friday night? All day Saturday, Sunday morning, and they sent out a schedule. Chris sent me a prospective schedule, you know, and it said 9 to 10, Charlie, step 1, 10, you know, 10, 15. And I'm sitting there looking at the schedule, and I go, oh, I'm going to need more time, you know. I mean, you know? Because it wouldn't seem like it, but I've really been trying to haul ass through a lot of material here, and we got some more stuff to cover this morning. But some of the stuff, you know, we rarely get through all the steps in a workshop like this. Sometimes we'll get to 7, sometimes we'll get to 9, sometimes we'll get through the spiritual disciplines of 10 and 11. Sometimes we'll even touch on 12 a little bit. But one of the things I want to talk about is I want to recap a little bit of what we've covered, and then hopefully there'll be some takeaway from a weekend like this. What is the takeaway? What are we going to try to look at differently? What are we going to try to do differently? What different advice would I give? How would I respond differently to a phone call from a sponsee? You know, I'm going to try to roll it out. That's a good idea. I should turn my phone off. I've only had my phone ring at the podium one time, but being as self-centered as we are, I've always wondered what happened if you went, hold on a second. Yellow! Yeah, hey, you old knucklehead, let me hit you back. You know what I mean? We talked a little bit about what happens, you know, when you got a guy that has been around a while and he's relapsed, and being able to tell him that there's a different level of this deal available, you know, and what would that be? Because it's a dark spot when you've been around AA for 5 or 6 years and you've relapsed, and like I was saying, when you think, I can't keep getting loaded like I've been getting loaded, I can't imagine not getting loaded right now. And the only thing that works for you guys doesn't work for me. You know, I've been around AA, and I felt just as empty as I could be after X amount of time. You know, because I think there's a lot of message for the guy that's been around for a few years. And I call it untreated alcoholism. You know, my whole message is about speaking to untreated alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's rampant. You know, it's like I was saying, I really felt bad about not having really just nailed the whole program till I found out I had so much company. You know, I mean, there's just a whole bunch of people out there that are struggling and suffering in the rooms of, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I've had people come up and go, what is this untreated alcoholism that you're talking about? You know, and one guy goes, why didn't you get into service work? You know, and I was like, dude, did you hear my story? I mean, I was going to meetings and running wild out there. I mean, I wasn't even sure where my big book was. I mean, do you think I was going to go be the GSR? You know, I mean, It was not appealing to me, you know. So when we talk about untreated alcoholism, one really simple way to describe it is, if we all suffer from alcoholism with its characteristics and traits and that sort of thing, and the only treatment for that we know of is to continually work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, if I'm not engaged in that process, I'm not treating my alcoholism. So I would be in some stage or another of untreated alcoholism. And it's a real struggle. We're some real badasses, you know. I mean, some of the guys, I mean, to endure the level of interior pain that we can carry around in sobriety for as long as some of us do is not for wimps, you know. I mean, the bad thing about alcoholism is that we're stuck in a marathon and we're all sprinters. You know, I like to go like hell for a couple of weeks, and then, like Mark used to say, the definition of an alcoholic is it's somebody that finds something that works really well, and then we quit doing it. You know, and it's like, you know, so you know, we're going to talk a little bit about that. But I got in a conversation with Bruce last night, and you know, one of the beauties of doing a workshop, and when you do a one-hour talk, you always step down and you sit there, and I rarely regret something I said. It's always the stuff I forgot to say. You know, you get down and you go, oh, God dang it, I was going to talk about that, or I was going to. And in a workshop, you can actually kind of circle back and pick it up, except we're running out of time. You know, I'll be recapping on the plane going, oh, you know, can I come, just give me 30 more minutes, you know. But one of the things that I can't believe that I didn't talk about, you know, when I was talking to Bruce last night that came up, is what we call, you know, we've talked a lot about self. I mean, I try to pound it. And really the way I read the book, it seems like the book is pounding selfishness and self-centeredness as the root of my problem. And all the work seems to be about reduction of self and manifestations of self and that sort of thing. And it's interesting. I didn't think about it for a long time. I'm going to jump around some this morning unapologetically. I'm just doing the best I can. But, you know, up in the 10th step, it talks about we find that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. And I remember reading that and thinking, what are they talking about, no thought or effort on my part? I've been busting my ass here. I've been doing inventory. I've been making amends. I've been doing, you know, all this stuff. It wasn't until the focus became on self and selfishness and manifestations of self that I realized that none of that work has been on alcohol. Right? We do the third step over here where the book takes that turn we talked about on page 60. And I start working on manifestations of self and reductions of self and what's blocking me from this power. And then we pop up over here in step 10 and the problem has been removed. I'm safe and protected, that sort of thing. But it's interesting that none of it was focused on not drinking, not drinking, not drinking, not drinking, don't drink no matter what, you know, and that sort of thing. So, but one of the things that we talk about when you talk about a guy that's struggling in sobriety, well into sobriety, a lot of times what they're running up against and what I was running up against is what I call the second surrender in AA. I hit a bottom at 4.5 years in sobriety, a sound, hard bottom when that first marriage blew up. And then I hit another one at 7 years. And that's the one where I kind of pulled away from AA and thought, you know, screw rigorous honesty. I'm going to get mine. You know, I'll show you what half measures will do and, you know, that sort of thing. It was a brilliant choice. I wanted one that I made on my own, you know. But then I hit another bottom at about 17 years, about the time of that plane crash. And the thing that I'm looking back on it is what I call the second surrender. And the first surrender in AA is the surrender to alcohol and drugs and that sort of thing. And that's really a fairly easy surrender because I've just had a thorough ass whipping. You know, I mean, it's easy to surrender when a gorilla's got his foot on your throat, you know. This second surrender is a little more subtle, and it's the surrender to self-will. You know, when it says the first requirement is that I be convinced that any life based on self-will can hardly be a success, that's not an easy thing to convince me of. You know, in fact, it's been my operating system for all of my life. And when you're up against the collapse of self-will, it doesn't look like we're going to go, oh boy, I sense that I'm just about to have a spiritual awakening, you know? It feels like the collapse and failure of every value and everything I've ever based my entire life on. You know, that I got this, and, you know, and I'll take care of this. And when that fails, it's rough. And, you know, we weren't having these conversations in the guys I was hanging out with, you know. And so it was interesting. I didn't have anybody in my life when I was hitting the wall at 4.5 years sober, at 7 years sober, going, you remember when I thought, you know, I've tried it your way and I'm getting knocked to the mat every time I step in the ring? I didn't have anybody in my life saying, Charlie, you're not up against the failure of Alcoholics Anonymous. What you're running up against is the failure of self-will. This is what it looks like when you're running the show and completely selfish and self-centered. And it changes the whole focus of the way that... that we sponsor now, you know. I mean, and I don't know at whatever we're going to talk about it, but I mean, now when guys are calling me to sponsor, I'm always looking for the selfishness. I'm looking at their take. How is their take selfish and delusional and dishonest and self-seeking and that sort of thing? And how can we look, you know, that exercise in the sick man prayer where it says, are you prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle? I'm always thinking, well, how can there be another angle on this? You know, and it completely changes the way you sponsor. And sometimes what seems so obvious, I'm blind to it in myself. I can spot selfishness in sponsees. Oh my God, I could just tell you stories. I mean, I probably will. You know, I mean, my favorite, I got this guy, Chris, the pepper guy we were talking about at breakfast. And this guy is a complete idiot. And I just love him with all my heart. You know, I mean, because the thing I love about Chris is he is just pure alcoholism personified. You know, there's no filters, there's no shame, there's no attempt to mask his motives or selfishness. It just comes out with his take, and you go, oh my God, you know, you can't help but love him. One time, the guys come over on Thursday night, and we usually eat, and then we have the meeting, you know, and I'd come back from Louisiana, I brought back a bunch of andouille sausage and red beans and rice and stuff. And so we're going to have andouille sausage. And the links are about this long, you know. And it's steaming in this pot. And the moment that I take the lid off the pot, Chris is there with his plate, you know, like this. And I go, dude, you don't get a whole link, you know. I said, look around this kitchen. I said, look in that pot. I said, how many links of sausage do you see in there? And he goes, 9. I said, okay. I said, how many men do you see in this kitchen? He goes, 1. How do you not love that guy, you know? I wanted to give him a whole link, you know. That level of selfishness deserves to be rewarded. Oh my God. And it's just all the time. And he's the one that when I started working with him, he's one of the only ones I've ever had. You know how it says we think well before taking a step and a third step? He's one of the only ones I ever had that said, you know, I need to think about this. And I was frustrated because I'd put my best stuff on him in step one and step three. And when it came time to do the prayer, he goes, and I've talked to Lorenz, and he goes, well, he's thinking well, you know. And we came back and we did it. But the funny thing about it was in that selfishness, he goes, I don't have the selfishness. He says, I'm not selfish like that, like you talk about it. So in fact, I was an honest dope dealer, and I thought we should write that down somewhere, you know, honest dope. But the funny thing about it is when it's an example of how blind we are to self. Part of living a life based on selfishness and self-centeredness is I have almost no awareness of my effect on other people. You know, and so he's rocking along. He's married, got a baby and all this stuff. And he's like, I'm not selfish at all. And the reason I tell it is because like a year later, the phone rings and he goes, when does the selfishness stop? I said, brother, I don't know the answer to that question. I said, but I know it's more than 28 years, you know, because Because and it doesn't even apply imply in the book that it's going to go away. You know, in the third, it's in my DNA, that selfish reaction. And if you look in those third step promises, it says, established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. You know, it's a lifetime project staying on, keeping my finger on the pulse of my self-centeredness. You know, that's it's all my work all the time. You know, it's evening review, it's morning meditation, it's a spot check inventory through the day. And but this second surrender, it's tough, man. I mean, you know, and so a lot of times when you see a guy that's struggling in sobriety, that's where I go to with him. You know, I have a few questions I'll ask. You know, where I go. The guy that came to me in Oklahoma, I usually don't say where he lived, but the guy that came to me and said that he couldn't shake the idea of killing himself. I said, let's go talk for a minute. You know, and we're talking, and I said, are you sponsoring anybody? And he goes, no. I said, do you do prayer and meditation or anything? And he goes, no, not really, not for a while. I said, do you ever do a spot check inventory during the day? Call your sponsor when you're pissed off or anything like that? And, nah, not really. And I said, where are you at with the amends process? And he goes, well, I mean, I made the big ones, you know, to my mom and my wife and stuff like that, but most of them are still there. And I said, okay, how long since you wrote inventory? And he goes, 16 years. He says, my sponsor said you only do one inventory, and I haven't done one since I was. And I said, this is all really good news. You know, I said, because if you were doing all that stuff and thinking about offing yourself, we'd have to get really creative. You know, might have to try that whole acceptance thing or something, you know. But I mean, we got an answer for what's bothering you, and it's going to be, you know, actually involving yourself in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That second surrender feels like the end of the world. You know, when you're rocking along, how many guys have hit a bottom in sobriety? So don't feel lonely. You know, I mean, I for a long time, I felt like I was the only one with struggles in sobriety. It felt like everybody was getting up to the podium and talking about, you know, I had all this stuff going on in my life, and then I walked through those doors. And ever since then, it's just been caring and sharing and unconditional love. And I'm out there going, what is wrong with me? You know, my basic, I mean, don't think I'm out here working this deal perfectly. I mean, I gave a chip to a sponsee at this big treatment center in Austin one night. And the next day, I have to get all prayed up before I go in a Sprint store. I have to pre-pray like crazy to deal with Sprint. I've written inventory on Sprint. I've done, you know, and so the next day, I go in the Sprint store, and I'm trying to get my way. And this little guy behind the counter is kind of starting to see things my way. And about that time, this manager comes up and blows the whole deal up, you know. And at one point, I find myself rolled up on my knuckles on the counter, hollering at this guy. And the whole place, and see, the thing about it is when I'm in self-will like that, it feels like common sense. It you know, delusion feels like God's will, you know. And I can't, because I'm thinking I don't mind anybody hearing me because they need to know what an outrage is taking place here, you know. And the guy goes off, the manager goes off to the back, and I'm standing there, and I look over, and this guy's over here, and he's kind of grinning at me, kind of funny, you know, and I go, oh, man, I said, they're getting me kind of worked up in here. And he goes, did you see me get my 90-day chip last night? You know, and talk, just pants down around your ankles, you know. I said, brother, what you just saw was not exactly, yeah, the funnel. Yeah, yeah. No, I couldn't even give myself an A- on that one. You know, I said, what you just saw was not the principles of our program in action. You know, I said, in fact, if you stick around a few more minutes, you'll get to see what an active 10th step looks like. You know, oh, my God. But, you know, out there operating on that self, well, I don't know it. I don't know that I'm blowing stuff up. I don't understand why people are pissed off. I don't know, you know. And you know, I've started noticing that that in apologies to my wife, they love it when I, she loves it when I pepper in words like selfish and inconsiderate and thoughtless and that sort of thing, because that's what it always is. You know, I don't see why they're so pissed off. And I've had big beefs with Katie. I mean, big ones. I mean, we are two passionate people. We are type A, type A, and we were best friends for 20 years. So there's going to be some flare-ups. I mean, and plus we had 20 years of me pulling her pigtails. You know, I mean, when she was like my kid sister, and we were in an argument one day, and she goes, okay, you're starting to bug me. And I go, oh, honey, I don't think I could live with myself if I thought I was bothering you. That would just kill me, you know. Wasn't helping, you know. But she's constantly pointing out ways that I'm selfish and self-centered, and a lot of this is stuff. So it's interesting when I'm listening to guys talk. I'm thinking, how can we look at this from a different angle? Where has he been? And I'm doing the fourth column stuff for him, you know, in that conversation, you know. And sometimes you got to do a little fact finding and fact facing mission, you know, where I'm asking questions as they're going along. And I had one guy that called me, and it's important to say that any story I tell up here is the one where I've asked the guy, that's great, could I tell that story? And they go, yeah, that'd be fine. You know, I don't just, you know, pull stuff out of people's inventory and go, this will be entertaining, you know. But this was the guy that was irritated. Remember the one where I was saying I was irritated at work and I was irritated with my wife, and I was saying, I don't think you'd like being described as irritable, you know? Because the thing about it is, when I'm when you know the difference between being irritated and being irritable? Is that when I'm irritated, it's their fault, right? When I'm irritable, it's my fault, you know? And Katie is the one that says, if I'm going to be free, the problem's got to be me. My work has always got to be how, you know, and I used to do an exercise with myself where I'd go, this is going to be a very abstract thought, but what if I'm the asshole here? You know? You know? It's like, yeah, well, if I've had 12 roommates, maybe I'm not the best roommate there is out there, you know, and that sort of thing. But one of the things that Katie will work with, you know, when we're doing this second, all this focus on stuff, is she calls it the list, you know, because, you know, we always have such brilliant motives. And I was telling the guys one time, I had one case of gout in my life, you know, and it was during the international. I couldn't walk. I'm in a boot, you know, and we go to this doctor, and he goes, have you ever had diabetes? I said, no. He goes, have you ever had gout? And I was like, damn it, man. I said, my wife is sitting right here, you know. Are you going to go through the whole fat guy list of ailments, you know? And it's not gout, you know. And, well, it was gout, you know. And one little pill would knock it out. And that's the only time it's ever, but there's been a couple of little hot spots. And the bottle is sitting right there on the counter in the bathroom. And Katie misses nothing. I mean, nothing. I mean, you know, I've been with guys before. I was out at a play one time with this guy, and he goes, Charlie. And I turn, and I'm looking into this big cleavage, you know, and I turn back, and I go, dude, if you think Katie missed that, you are out of your mind. I was like, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, this is the last time we ever go out with this couple, you know. And as soon as we got in the car, Katie was like, oh, that's some bullshit, you know. I mean, you know. Yeah. Guy out there bird dogging for my husband, you know, and I don't want to be the girl in the marriage where the guy's out bird dogging all the time, and you know. So, but anyway, I digress. When I say she misses nothing, I took the bottle of pills and I just broke one in half, and I took half of one and I put it right back where it was, and she walks in there, you know, hours later, and she walks in and she goes, did you take one of those pills? I said, no. I took half of one. And she goes, did you just lie to me? And I go, well, I didn't want to scare you. You know, I didn't want you to be scared. She goes, I believe that's on the list of your motives. You remember this thing here? You know, I think that's probably on the list of your motives, but it's nowhere near the top of the list. You know, I mean, and that's one of the things I look at when sponsees are talking to me. It's like, because when we want to bring the story about, you know, like I told Mark Houston one time, I said, the reason I didn't divorce that woman in New York for so long was because I didn't want to hurt her feelings, you know, and Mark had this laugh where he goes, and I'm sitting on the couch going, what, pray tell, is so funny, you know? And he goes, I've just listened to you read an inventory to me for 2.5 hours, and you expect me to believe that you're afraid to hurt somebody's feelings? So the thing with that list is, she goes, you know, there's a list of your motives, but not wanting to scare me is about number 5 on that list. You know, the number 1 is, you know, I don't want to be called on the way I've been eating. I don't want to change the way I've been eating. I don't want to have that address. I don't want to, you know, and then somewhere down the line is that scares Katie. And the selfish side of it for her is, and we've talked about this, she's a fitness professional. She's built like she's carved out of wood. And then there's me. And but the other side of it is, part of the selfish reason why she doesn't want anything bad to happen to her husband, because then she's alone, or even worse, she's got to train another one, you know. And I'm some of her best work, man. I mean, I've gone through 10 years of intensive training, you know. Oh my God, this, I've never said this anywhere before, but I'm in the bathroom one day. And she says, hey, can you give me a courtesy flush in there? And I go, oh, please tell me how to take a dump. You know, I'm like, it's the only, I can't believe this is on CD. I said, it's the only area of my life that's gone unexamined to this point. You know, I mean, we might as well throw that in the pot. You know, I mean, But watching this stuff, I mean, the guy from Alabama was the one that called me, and he says, he's irritated at work, and there's this guy that bugs him. He's a union worker, and there's a guy at work that's a supervisor, and I don't like the guy. I don't like him telling me what to do. I don't like him, you know, writing my, you know, he's going on about this whole deal. And I start talking, and as we're doing the fact-finding and fact-facing mission, I'm like, now, what's his position, and what's your position? And it turns out my guy used to be a supervisor, and now he's not a supervisor anymore. And when you talk about looking at it from an entirely different angle, I go, because I don't like it. He'll yell at me if I'm a little bit late, or if he doesn't like the way something is done, or, you know, he didn't need to come at me like that, and, you know, that sort of thing. And I go, so when we start looking at selfishness, I go, is it possible? I said, that what you're asking this guy to do is compromise his relationship with the company that he works for. You want him to undermine the job he's been asked to do for this company in order to give you special treatment, because you don't want to be held accountable when you're late or when you take a shortcut on a project. And I said, so it sounds to me like you're resentful of your supervisor for supervising you. And he's like, damn, I don't like it when you say it like that. You know? I mean, but we see how powerful that, looking at that from a different angle, that when you poke through that delusion. But that second surrender is really worth looking at a lot. It changes the whole focus of my work, is that first surrender to alcohol, and the second surrender is to self-will. And the more we examine the depth of my selfishness, the more work there is to do there. You know, I mean, and that's what's so beautiful about it. Some guys, you have to really be creative, because self manifests differently in different people. You know, me, I'm kind of like that Chris guy. You know, I mean, it's kind of front and center. You know, it's pretty easy to spot. Some guys are a lot more subtle than that. You know, there could be the guy that would never say anything. You know, one of my sponsors was like, "Oh, I would never yell at the sprint guy. That would never happen with me." And I said, "But that doesn't make him any less selfish than I am. It manifests differently for him." You know, so a lot of times the work is looking at how does self manifest for Tom as different from Bill, or, you know, things like that. Because I've never seen anybody that has graduated out of this level of work. I mean, it changes. And I was talking to Chris one day, the same guy, you know, that didn't have any self. There's some sponsees you kind of have to nurture a little bit. And then there's some guys you can't take your foot off their throat for 2 seconds, you know. And I was more like the latter group. You know, and Chris is like that. I don't need to be patted on the back. And, you know, I don't need to write down a list of my good traits, you know, I mean, because those aren't the ones that are killing me, you know. But with Chris, I'm just pounding him all the time, you know, and we can't figure out why, you know, with that level of selfishness that we're talking about, you know, and a guy will be complaining about his sex life at home, you know, and I'm like, look at what she lives with, you know. I mean, she's dealing with this selfish, self-obsessed, inconsiderate, thoughtless dude that's about nothing but nurturing and comforting himself. You know, Mark used to talk about building character rather than seeking comfort. Whatever. You know, I am all about seeking comfort, you know. And I was like, and to have that level of selfishness on me, on her all the time, and I can't figure out why she's not wearing Victoria's Secret outfits when I come through the door, you know. Just saying, you know. I was like, oh, I can't wait to get some of that, you know. It's a different thing to look at, and it changes the focus of the way the work goes. And I have a pair of glasses in here somewhere. Here they are. Got them. What time are we starting? 9:30? Okay. Well, talking about the amends process. We did a little 6 and 7. Okay, I want to back up. I want to backtrack just a little bit. I forgot one really important piece of we didn't really talk much about the fifth step yesterday. We talked a good deal about the inventory process and how to look at resentments and fears and sex and harms to others as manifestations of self and that sort of thing. But one of the things that I didn't talk about was the fifth step. And it's interesting, the book really gives very little instruction on how to hear a fifth step. I think a lot of the stuff we're talking about the fact-finding and fact-facing mission, sometimes I'm telling you, when it talks about swallowing and digesting large chunks of truth about ourselves, I mean, I do inventory now where you have to go, hold on just a minute. I'm swallowing and digesting some large chunks of truth about myself. You know, sometimes it feels like glass going down when you get really confronted with that entirely different angle where you go, oh, my God, you know, that one, you know. And so the thing that I did, and really the book talks about we basically pocket our pride and go to it. It talks about who we do it with and the spirit we take into it and that sort of thing. But when we get into, oh, God bless you, big time. We should nominate this guy for something. I was just sitting here thinking I should have gotten some water up here. I'm now 6 feet away from the fire. This whole side is toasted. Whoever's tending this fire is kicking ass. We have gone through a pretty admirable stack of wood out there too. At the end of the fifth step, one of the things, when you get to the end of the fifth step, it mentions an hour. Let me see where that is. About 75. I tell guys that I'm doing the inventory with, and I hear a lot of inventory. Nothing like my wife, though. I swear to God, I was talking, who was I talking to at breakfast about Katie being better at hearing inventory? Yeah. And I was saying that, I forgot your first name.
Zach.
We were talking about, you know, how can she be better at hearing inventory then? What does that mean? I bet Katie hears an average of 15 hours of inventory a week. She's constantly got peace. You heard 3 hours yesterday from a lady from Bermuda. We were in Bermuda last weekend, and she did 3 hours with this lady on her husband. And I saw a text from the woman this morning that was pretty powerful, you know. But, you know, being able to take this stuff to a depth and be able to see where motives and selfishness and old ideas, what old ideas are driving me. You know, when it says driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, what's driving me? A lot of times it's my old ideas, you know. Men should, no man should ever, a woman should always, a boss should. You know, a lot of these old ideas that are driving me can get melded into hearing that inventory and helping them with that entirely different angle and that thing. But one of the things I tell guys after we do the fifth step promises are powerful. It says, once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. It's kind of interesting. I had a sponsor, he called me on the way home one time, and he goes, I'm not delighted. You know, he said, I feel like we just spent 3.5 hours of you rubbing my face and how selfish and self-centered and thoughtless and inconsiderate I am. I'm not feeling real delighted. And I said, well, you got to look at it like this. If we're looking at getting rid of the things in ourselves that are blocking us, you wouldn't want to come out of a fifth step without anything to look at. I said, you know, this is real stuff that we're going to take to God in 6 and 7. And when you go back where it says we avoid remorse and morbid self-reflection, because what happens is it's just another manifestation of self. It's kind of like that screw tape thing we were talking about. It's like you got the ego saying, okay, I come into this inventory process completely self-righteous and self-centered. You lay all this stuff out for me, and I go wham all the way over here to what a piece of crap I am, and I don't deserve to draw air, and oh my God, you know, I'm just the worst guy there ever was. And that's just another manifestation of self. The ego is perfectly happy because the ego is going fine. As long as he goes into the inventory process thinking about himself and comes out of the inventory process thinking about himself, we can work with that, you know. That's why it says we avoid more remorse and morbid self-reflection, because it diminishes our usefulness to others. It's still got me staring into myself. You know, and so that's, I have to sometimes keep a guy from going too far into that during the amends process. Does that make sense? There's this hour that I used to not do much with at the end of the inventory. I consider it part of the fifth step. And I tell guys, when you schedule your fifth step with me, don't plan dinner with your family right after, because you're not done yet. You're not going to be done until you go home and do this hour that it talks about at the end of the fifth step. And I recorded some sessions at the table when Mark was there. You know, we call it the Common Solution. The name of that meeting is Common Solution, because we want to be one voice, one message. You know, whether you're working with whoever, you should be getting pretty much the same message. And but that one night, thank God I recorded it, because Mark went on a rant about the hour at the end of the fifth step. And I mean, Chad, one of my guys, was looking at Mark, and he'd look at me, and he'd look at Mark, and he's like, are you getting this? You know, and later he told me, he said, I think I absorbed about 10%, this was months later, of what Mark said about that hour. And that 10% revolutionized that hour at the end of the fifth step for me. Because what we talked about, it says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. And I've written 60 minutes, you know, one of those kind of hours. Carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. That's the prayer. Taking this book down from our shelf. I'm a bit of a literalist. I've never understood why my big book's on the shelf when I've just done a fifth step. But I put it up on the shelf and take it down from the shelf. You know, it's ridiculous, and I demand it. You know, but it says, taking this book down from my shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. I used to just kind of phone this one in. I'd go home, I'd spend an hour, I'd kind of read We Agnostics, and I'd read this stuff. But it says, carefully reading the first 5 proposals. And this is where Mark went off on it. He said, and considering them in all their implications. You know, so now all of a sudden I'm going back through those first five steps and I'm going, do I believe that I have a hopeless state of mind and body? Do I have a body that responds differently to alcohol than most people? And do I also get so uncomfortable in between drinks that it's going to trigger a mental obsession that's more powerful than I am, that's eventually going to get me to drink again? And when I drink, is it going to send me off on this run? Is this my condition? Do I find myself where on my own power I've got no shot? And have I made it? Do I find myself where my only choices are live life on a spiritual basis, die an alcoholic death? And if that's so, do I believe that there's a power that can take me beyond where we are today? Have I made a decision in the third step to get nearer to that power? And do I know what the problem is? Do I believe, am I convinced that my life run on self-will can hardly be any success? And if so, am I the actor that tries to run the whole show? Do I operate under this delusion that if everybody would act right, everything would be okay? And what usually happens? Does the show not come off very well? Do I try to be more manipulative? Do I use that toolkit of self-will? Am I really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Am I a producer of confusion rather than harmony? And, you know, and if so, is selfishness and self-centeredness the root of my problem? And do I know what that means? And do I know what that looks like? And I'm sitting there reflecting on all the implications of the first five steps. And if that's the case, have I made a decision to quit playing God? And do I know what that looks like? And do I know what that means? And do I understand the root of the problem? Do I really think that my problems are of my own making? You know, and carrying all those implications into this hour, where now have I made this decision? And if so, am I making an effort to remove what's blocking me from this power? If this power is my only shot, do I believe that? And would you be able to tell that if you followed me around? You know, and so now have I done my inventory based on those things, and have I looked at all these things in a resentment? And I mean, and it's unbelievable. I mean, but it puts so much meat on the bone for that hour that always for me before had just been something you kind of phone in. You know, you spend an hour and then go on to six and seven. And then taking all that reflection and all the implications from the fourth column of my inventory into steps six and seven. Six and seven becomes more and more and more the basis of my work these days. So many times I'm coming up against things that I admit, in six, it's all about admitting that it's objectionable and I don't have the power to change it. And seven is about asking God to change it, you know, if it needs to be changed, you know. And I'm up against, there's a lot of stuff that I can, I mean, clearly you don't want to hear my diet talk, you know, But I've never, you know, there are times when I've never really made it a real piece of business with God. You know, the only thing I ever attack it with is self-will. You know, where I get up in the morning and I go, by God, I'm sick of being this big. It's the biggest I've been in 20 years. I'm going to do, that's it. Till lunchtime, you know. And I always say I always want to lose weight except for when it's time to eat, you know. And then one of the things that I've had to do with Katie is, we've had some jackpots before where she's the one that's there in the morning when I've hit bottom and I want things to be different. And by God, I'm sick of this and I'm going to try to eat better. And please help me eat better, you know, and that sort of thing. And then also that night we're at a conference or something. And we go out with people and I get the menu out and I go, what do you think about the Fat Boy special here? You know, and she's like, well, you might want to look at a salad, you know, And then the people there at the table go, come on, let him eat, you know, for God's sake. And that's when Katie's like, I'm out, you know. It's not going to be like that where you ask me to help you and then make me look like the bitch that's riding your ass, you know, at dinner that night. But see, I mean, you see the selfishness in that? I didn't. You know? Had to have that one pointed out to me, you know. But I mean, and the other thing, and the thing about it is, one of the things we do in our family, there's some things we do that, one thing is I'm real big on do-overs. Real big on do-overs with my wife and some of my kids. But do-overs are a big thing in our family, where if you realize you really just screwed the deal up, you know, it's like, could I have a do-over on that? You know, and we'll do it differently. You know, I mean, it can be as simple as, One time she came home and she'd spent 3.5 hours getting her hair done, you know, and I didn't even pay any attention to it. It's very important to pay attention to that stuff, you know. I mean, because when they're spending 3 hours getting their hair done, I need to be out there with a pair of binoculars going, oh, my God. So I said, could I have a do-over on that, please? You know, and she, I swear to God, she walked back out, got back in her car, pulls in the drive. I mean, it's in the garage, but she gets back in the car. She opens the door, steps out, and I went, oh, my God, look at your hair. I was like, it's fantastic. You know, did you change something? You know, and she's like, oh, I know, you know, and all this stuff. And, I mean, healing stuff, you know. You talk about being able to go back and do some of this stuff over. But the other thing, one of the other tools that we use in our house, and I'm just kind of scatter shooting this morning. One of the things we do is if you make a public harm, you have to do a public apology. You know, I've had to apologize in front of 250 people before, you know, because we were doing a workshop one time in Little Rock, Arkansas, Fort Smith, Arkansas, and I let her look like an asshole, you know, and it was one of those things where, you know, they even clapped, you know, when I said something that kind of made her look like the hard ass, and everybody clapped like, you know, and, You can't imagine the tax on a event like that. And it was one of those things, like, let's just say it was like food, where I had to come back and go, guys, we believe if there's a public, because it doesn't, if you embarrass somebody in front of 12 people and then you apologize at the house by yourself, it doesn't carry the same weight as if you apologize in front of those 12 people. I've had to go back and call everybody that was at a dinner table one time, you know, and stuff like that. Public harm, public amends. I'm just saying, you know, it's stuff that has worked really well around the house as far, and it's all stuff that I was sound asleep to. Mark talked an awful lot about walking around asleep, dreaming I'm awake. And I'm just sleepwalking through my sobriety, and I got no awareness at all of my effect on the people around me and people like that. And so I'm going to talk about that in the amends process. We got a few minutes. Very interesting thing. On page 76, we've done 6 and 7. You know, I think it would be shocking to most guys that are in, you know, to know that when they show up, I've done a step 1 meeting with them. I've done a step 3 meeting with them, and I've lined them out and written inventory. I think it would be surprising to most of them to know that when they come over to the house that night to do their fifth step, that they're going to do 5, they're going to go home and do the hour, do 6 and 7, and write an amends list, and that night they're going to be in 9, 10, 11, and 12. You know, I mean, I can't find the place in the steps where it says chill. You know, I mean, it seems like in a golf swing, it's like, we're just going to do this work of what's blocking me. And it's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. You know, I look at it. I see where it is. I admit where it's objectionable. I don't have the power to change it. I make the amends for the harms I've done with that behavior. And it's just like that. Or I can stop it as an exercise in self-will and just say, I'm glad I caught that. I was really screwing up there for a minute. I'm gonna do better. And then God's got nothing to do with it. And the ego's going, that's fine, fine. We still got him. You know, you got to read the screw tape letters sometime. Has anybody read screw tape letters? It's all over me. It's a very interesting, it's a tongue-in-cheek thing that C.S. Lewis did. It's not AA literature. But boy, did he, you know, I mean, it talks about these, there's a head demon and he's who's screw tape and he's got a nephew named Wormwood. And Wormwood's, you know, in charge of this one guy. And all you hear is his letters to screw tape about, you know, the guy's going to church now. And you know, and the screw tape, all you hear is his responses. But when they, it talks a lot about the way my brain undermines my spiritual connection, and a lot of it is stuff like going, although this is not good news, see if you can get them involved in heady arguments and discussions and get them, and it's like, I think if you can do that, you'll be quite pleased with the results, you know, and stuff. It may not be as bad as it looks, you know, he's writing inventory, but we can even turn that into an exercise in self-will, you know, it's interesting, but... All right, just one. Hey, man, it's all good. Well, So when you've come over and you've done five, six, seven, eight, now it says, the thing about the amends process, there is a tremendous amount of instruction in the book about how to make amends. And then there's even a line there where it says, although these reparations take innumerable forms. So a lot of times it's going to, you know, it's not always going to be the same take on a guy that owes, you know, I'm nervous about hard, fast rules in the amends process, you know, because I hear people say, like, they have some established ones. You know, like one guy was like, well, you don't make amends to dope dealers. And I was like, I don't know. I mean, I never really knew anybody that had a shingle, you know, that said dope dealer. I mean, usually they were friends of mine that had spotted me some money based on our relationship. And I generally know whether or not it's somebody I need to make amends to or not. But there's going to be some conversation about some of that stuff, you know. And that's a pretty fiery one to bring out. But in the amends process, we're not going to have time to hit it a whole lot. But listen to what it says in the middle of 76. Now we need more action, right? Quite the opposite of chill and make some meetings for a while, you know, see if you can get a girlfriend. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Interesting. We get a lot of grief at PPG, Primary Purpose Group, for using outside literature. The reason there's quotation marks around faith without works is dead is because they're quoting the book of James from the Bible. So they're quoting outside literature in the big book. I'm just saying. You know, but it says, let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. Third step. Selfishness, self-centeredness, the root of my problem. 4 and 5, being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated me, we considered self's common manifestations. If I missed all that, what did I do when I get to step 8? And it says, we attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and to run the show ourselves. What? I mean, it's just all over the work. And I don't just, that's why I talk about that set-aside prayer and the fact that I like to read the book and look for things that I already agree with. Sometimes if I'm not looking for new information, a line like that just goes right over my head. And it says, remember, it was agreed at the beginning that we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. And there's about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, at least 7 places in the book where it talks about asking the guy if he's willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. One of the things I do when I start working with a guy, when he gets his big book, I say, first of all, write your name and your phone number in the front of that big book. Because your big book looks just like everybody else's big book. And, you know, we're going to do some work in it. But give us a chance, if you leave it somewhere, to get it back to you. Just write your name and phone number in the front of that book. And the other thing I'll have them do is on the very first page, I'll have them write, I'm willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Usually we'll do that after the first step meeting. And the fun thing about that is they don't see it coming. But when they balk later on, you can say, do me a favor, get your big book out and turn to that first page in there and tell me what it says. And they're like, I know what it says, you know. You know, because once the heat's off, I start acting like I'm almost powerless over alcohol, you know. And when I'm almost powerless over alcohol, I don't really have to make all the amends, you know. You notice the two biggest problems in the eighth step are the word all. It says, made a list of all persons we have harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Yikes. Mark showed up at our table after when I talked to him into starting that meeting at the house. There was never one time that he walked into that house that I didn't know this is a big deal. You know, it was like having Sandy Beach or some of my heroes, and, you know, walking in the house every Thursday night, making a priority out of making this meeting at the house. And I knew it was a big deal. Not all the guys did. One of the things when we sat down, I'll never forget it, you know, because when you start working with a new guy, you go, I got a new sponsor. I really need to kick my deal up a little bit. What's the first thing you always want to do? Well, for me, it was, you think, I'm going to get with this new guy, and we're probably going to write inventory. Always want to write inventory, right? Mark would go, what happened to the amends from the last time you wrote inventory? I'm like, how rude. You know, because he sat down at the table that first night. We're all just kind of talking, getting a feel for each other. And he goes, where are you at in the amends process? And I said, well, I'm 17, 18 years sober at this time. I said, well, I mean, I've made a lot of them, but there's a whole bunch that I haven't made, you know. And these are ones from 17 years ago. And there's a ton of them that I owe in sobriety, you know, like the guy at the Sprint store. And, you know, I mean, just when you live like that, amends are going to pop to the surface, you know. And he sat down there and he goes, I'll never forget it. I can tell you where he was sitting. He goes, I have a feeling there's a significant experience available for you guys in the amends process. And we thought he'd done some kind of Jedi mind trick on us or something. You know, it's like, how did he know that? You know, and it's because nearly all of us have a substantial experience available in the amends process. Because what happens for me is I make the list. And I do the tornado ones, you know. I always say the first people that are touched by the tornado are going to, I'm going to go to them, you know. But I mean, it's going to be my significant other and my parents and, you know, a guy at work and that sort of thing. But somewhere about that time, and maybe some of the financial ones, I made one to Delta Airlines, I made the IRS and, oh, Winn-Dixie, and a bunch of them ends. But then somewhere along the line, the list just kind of made its way to a drawer somewhere. And so we sat down, and one of the things we do, and we've talked a lot about spiritual consent this weekend and about the path of consideration, that sort of thing. If you're lucky enough to have a close group of guys that you can establish spiritual consent with, it is a powerful recovery tool where you get a half a dozen guys and you go, I want to establish spiritual consent. I'm giving you the right to call me on any behavior you see me doing, whether you think it's going to hurt my feelings or not. And then following that path of consideration where all I get to do is say thank you when you say, you know, you look like a guy that's starting to run the show again or whatever the consideration is. It's a wonderful thing because otherwise we get involved in what I call unsigned death pacts with each other where it's like, listen, you don't call me on my gambling, I won't say anything to you about screwing the secretary or, you know, whatever it is, you know, and we have these little unsigned death pacts with each other and which work really great until one of us drinks or blows our brains out, you know. So, I mean, holding somebody to a high level of this deal is a real privilege. But one of the exercises we did that I didn't see coming was one night at the table, we're all sitting down. I said, you know, guys, let's all, between now and next Thursday, write down your list of amends, current amends that you owe to people that you're aware of right now. And we're going to meet together. We've all got spiritual consent with each other. We're going to meet together next Thursday, and we're going to read our amends list. Holy mackerel, I did not see what a heavy exercise that was going to be coming. Because one of the things I can tell you is if you get together with some of your boys and you start reading your amends list, you better keep your pen handy, you know, because we'd be sitting there and, you know, I got my list and then one guy goes, I ran out of a bunch of restaurants without paying. And you're like, okay, you know, and this other guy goes, I bought gas and drove off without paying, you know, a few times. Like, oh. And then another guy says, I robbed my parents of the emotional security in their home and took away their dreams of the son they were going to have. And you go, so we're going all the way there, huh? You know? You know, and so, you know, now all of a sudden my list is getting longer, you know. I mean, because when I say that one of the bad sides of living a life based completely on selfish and self-centeredness is I have very little awareness over my effect on other people. One of the things we do in the amends process, and I'm going to tie this up, one of the things that we do in the amends process is we use amends cards. And I take a little 3x5 business card and I write down who the person is, their contact information, the nature of the harm, And then I got three questions that I put on the bottom of that. And I always forget to say one of the questions, so don't let me do that. But the first question is, how can I make this right? And then we put, shut up and listen. Second question, have I harmed you in any other way? Shut up and listen. And the last one is, do you need to tell me how this made you feel? Shut up and listen. The reason that one that says, have I harmed you in any other way, is so powerful is because, like I said, I don't have any awareness of my effect on other people. I would have gone to my sister, and on my amends list, I stole $15 out of my sister's purse one time to go drinking on it. And that was a real violation of my values, you know, but on my own skills, I would have gone to my sister and said, Carol, I stole $15 out of your purse, you know, and here it is, I'm really sorry, and that sort of thing. Can you see my sister going, really? Really? After pawning everything in our house and taking all the energy out of the house, you know, that should have been focused on me and focused it on this one screw-up of a son, putting our house in turmoil, taking my little brother and turning him into a junkie and a drunk, and dropping out of everything you were ever involved in, and after all that and the effects of living with that for 12 years, you think you're going to give me $15 and we're all square? This is really turning into an ugly conversation, you know. But see what I mean about, have I harmed you in any other way? That's how asleep I am. When I talk about walking around asleep, dreaming I'm awake, I think I owe my sister $15. Powerful, powerful stuff. One of the things that came up out of that is one time I was making amends to Katie, and we'd been married for a while. And when I say I'm some of her best work, I'm telling you, she didn't have a lot to work with. When we got together, I mean, I was a dog. And you know, and she had seen it, you know, for 20 years, I had no reason to hide anything from her. In fact, the more my behavior bugged her, the more it tickled me, you know. I mean, so, yeah, she's 19. What do you think about that, you know, and stuff like that. And it was just, I look back over some of the behavior that seemed normal then, and I go, were you out of your mind? I mean, why would you ever say that to any woman, much less the woman you're in a relationship with? I was talking to one of the guys last night about how one of the things we'll do as a sex addict is say stuff out loud and hope to normalize it, you know. I can't remember who I was having that conversation with. Yeah, I do. And it's, you know, I always say, you know, if you want to see manifestations of self, look how many times out in the world you'll just be talking to somebody and they do this. You know, you're like, what? You know? But I go to Katie and I make amends, you know, for all, everything I can think of, you know, the stuff that was going on early in the relationship, the harms I'd done to her, the way I'd embarrassed her, the stuff I'd done, and all this stuff. And when we get to the end of the amends, and it was a good session, I said, you know, honey, we did the, you know, do you want to tell me how this made you feel and all this stuff? And I said, have I harmed you in any other way? I said, if you need to take some time and build a list of other things that I've done that I'm not aware of, I'd be perfectly willing to sit down and have another session like this with you and go over that stuff. She said, thank you. I'd really appreciate that. So we're rocking along like the dumbass I am, you know, and we're going along one day. And you ever just hear yourself saying really stupid stuff? You know, I'm talking to her and I go, you remember that time I did that really hurtful, stupid thing at the bar? That And she goes, oh, yeah. And she goes, oh, yeah, that's on the list. And I go, what list is that? And she goes, well, you said I could take some time and make a list. And I went, oh, hold on now. You know, I said, I was talking about a few days or a week or something. This is 7 months later. All right? Now, she's not told me she's working on the list, and she hadn't told her sponsor that she's working on the list, but every time she'd think of something, she'd be like, oh. You know, but the other thing I wasn't aware of is that every time I'd piss her off or hurt her feelings, this whole little Rolodex would roll around in her head of other times that I'd offended her, embarrassed her, or hurt her feelings, you know, that sort of thing. So we sit down, and now she knows the cat's out of the bag, you know, because if Marty finds out that she's been sitting on the list for 7 months, the game's over, you know. So we sit down, and the reason I talk about it was we sat there, and she went over her list, and I wrote down everything that there was. There were 24 items. I'm not going to read the list to you. It's not an impressive list, you know. But the thing about it was, okay, there was stuff in there like one time we're at the Palms by the pool, and there was a Playboy golf tournament in town, and right when she looks over, her husband is giving it one of these. As this girl, it hurt her feelings and embarrassed her. You know, she didn't like being, you know, that's just a little thing. You know, I placed myself in a restaurant one time to be able to look at all these models in New York. Flirting with this one girl in Austin and kissing her on the lips whenever I'd see her. Emails. Retaliation to shame. I didn't realize it, but if you come at me with shame, I'm like that hockey player where the gloves are coming off. And I mean, it's like if you can just use a tone of voice with me, talking about driven by old ideas, if you just go, Charlie, I'll kill both of us. You know, I mean, you know, it's like, I didn't know it. I didn't know I was driven by that. You know, so she's got some, you know, explosive relationship. Right down the list, the reason that I talk about this is because every item on this list is a legitimate harm and something that I wound up apologizing for, and not one of them made my amends list. You know, that's the power of that little exercise of saying, have I harmed you in any other way? I think it's a really powerful thing, and the other thing is about making those cards, because my experience has been is that the list has a way of finding its way into a drawer. The cards have a way of haunting you. You know, the cards will sit on my desk, you know, and I'm looking at, you know, and I've made, in 2008, I had 42 cards, and I don't have any now. And just the other day, I thought of one amend that I owe. I will never say I've made all the amends for all the harms I've ever made, but what I do hope to be able to say is I've made amends for everything that I'm aware of. Because I went to a family funeral the other day, and my cousin Junior and his wife were there, and I realized that I went and spent a week at their farm one time, and I was so drunk so much of the time that we were there that they took me into town and introduced me to a guy that drank a lot and didn't drink anymore. These are country people that have introduced me, and I was so asleep, I didn't even know what was going on. You know, it was years before I looked back and went, that was a big deal for them, you know? And what kind of guests did they have in their home to find it necessary to go find somebody for Charlie to talk to, you know? And that just, one of the things I'll tell you is when you get into the amends, when your spirit gets into the amends process, things just start bubbling to the surface. Bloop, bloop, bloop. Over here, stuff that I'm never aware of. Katie and I were walking through Crested Butte one day. She thought I had a stomach cramp because we were walking along. I went, oh. And she goes, what? And I go, I was riding my dirt bike past a golf course one time, and I went and did a donut on the green and drove away, and these guys were shaking their golf clubs at me and stuff. And, you know, and I'll never forget calling that guy up and saying, I did a donut on the green at your golf course, and I'm really sorry about it. And we're talking, and he goes, when was that? And I said, best of my recollection, 1972. And I said, anything I can do to make that right? He goes, I'm pretty sure that grass is growing back by now. And I said, well, let me just tell you, it was thoughtless and inconsiderate, and I am truly sorry. And you know, that was the end of that one, you know, but. But, you know, right down the line, there is a significant experience available in the amends process that it generally, I have to ride my guys about it. You know, my other experience has been that if we tend to transmit our own experience to sponsees. So if I've done a half-assed job of doing the amends process, I'm not going to ride my sponsees about it. You know, and so with my guys, it has to be a part of almost every conversation is, where are you at with the circle and triangle? Have you made any approaches on any amends this week? You know, and I got to keep in mind, have you made any approaches? I'll talk about the circle and triangle check-in after the break. But because I do want to talk about, you know, since we've all been stamping these in our book, there's an exercise I do with the guys about it. But there's instructions throughout the book about how to make amends to loved ones. You know, the one thing I do want to say about the amends process, one of the things that really bugs me is when I hear people talking about making living amends. The only place in the book that it implies anything like living amends is in dealing with the family. It says, yes, there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. Most of the time, what people would describe as living amends is no more than just practicing these principles in all our affairs, right? If I stole some lady's TV, she doesn't give a flip that I'm not stealing TVs anymore. You know, she wants her TV back. You know, stopping stealing TVs is not making direct amends to this lady. I did a meeting one time, and I always say, if you don't want to make an amend, all you got to do is go to one of the big AA groups and bring it up to two or three people. The bulk of the advice in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is centered around not having to make the amends. Most of the places you go, somebody will tell you, you don't have to make that one. You know, that'll harm you or somebody or, you know, or whatever kind of, you know, but what's funny is when you hear people talk that have had spiritual awakenings as a result of this process, sometimes the most magical, powerful stuff has come out of making direct amends to these people we've harmed. There's no way to anticipate the ripple effect of what's going to come out of that, you know, I mean, and why would we want to talk somebody out of doing that? But I was chairing a meeting one time with a sponsee, and I said, you watch. I'm going to chair the meeting on making direct amends to all people we have harmed. And I watch people evade the topic, change the topic, or talk about why you don't have to do it. And at the end of the meeting, I said, what do you think? He goes, if you hadn't told me it was going to happen, I wouldn't have believed it. It was unbelievable. And this one woman during that meeting, she goes, I used to work at this company, and I was embezzling money from them, but I'm making living amends to them now because I'm working for a different company now, and I'm not stealing from them anymore. I'm just like, oh, my God, that's got to be really comforting to the other company, you know? You know, and can you imagine I go over to Tom's house, and I go, hey, Tom, I got to tell you something, brother. You know, remember when your golf clubs came up missing out of the garage? That was me, but I just want to tell you, I'm not doing that anymore. You know, I mean, isn't he going to feel like he's been made whole? You know, I don't know. There's a tremendous amount of instruction in there about how to handle different amends and get with somebody with the knowledge of the process and stuff, because it does say they take innumerable forms. And I want my sponsors to call me before every amend, you know, because sometimes you got to be careful. Like when I had one guy that was going out making amends to all these girlfriends, old girlfriends and stuff, and his wife is sitting there listening to make amends to other people. And, you know, his wife is sitting there going, when do I make the list? You know, but he didn't see that. You know, we got to be able to point that kind of stuff out. Let's take a little break, and we'll come back in for one more session, guys. I really appreciate it.